Serious objective. The reason we're spending this year doing it is because we're trying to reveal how from Genesis to Revelation, that God's big story is that he wants to be with us and he wants us to be with him. And the part of that is God is always with us. We know that. But sometimes we don't include him in our lives. We don't see him as a part of everything that's happening. And so our goal has been really to be able to help us all become more aware of living the with God life. And I really hope, because we're into the fifth month now, I really hope you're going to be able to embrace the redundancy as we talk about this over and over again. Because what I've found out is that even though I've been a Christ follower for almost 50 years, I still find it a daily challenge to live out this truth and remember that God is with me every step of the way. Well, today we're going to arrive at the book of Ecclesiastes. I do want to give a heads up to some of the parents that are here who bring their kids with them into church, and you are welcome always to do that. But next week, you're not going to want to miss next week, we're going to be looking at the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. And so that means we're going to be touching on what is to some a delicate subject of intimacy in marriage, which means we'll probably be mentioning the birds and the bees. And so I just want parents to be aware of that. It'll at least be a PG conversation, maybe PG-13, depending on your perspective. But we're not going to be graphic or go into any detail. We're just going to have some discussion. So we just have to say that. Well, let's jump into Ecclesiastes. There was an American investment banker who was standing on a pier in a small coastal fishing village in Mexico. And when a small boat with just one fisherman docked there at the little village there, inside the small boat were several large yellowfin tuna. And so the American complimented the fisherman on the quality of his fish and asked him how long it took to catch them. Well, the fisherman replied, it only took just a little while. And so the American asked, well, why didn't you stay out longer and catch more fish? And the fisherman said it was because that was all he needed to support his family's immediate needs. Well, the American asked him, he said, well, what do you do the rest of the time? And the fisherman said, well, I sleep late, I fish a little, I play with my children, I take siesta with my wife, Maria, I stroll into the village in the evening where I sip wine and play guitar with me amigos. I have a full and busy life. Well, at that, the American kind of scoffed and said, well, I have a Harvard MBA and I could help you. I think you ought to spend more time fishing and with the proceeds buy a bigger boat. And then with the proceeds from the bigger boat, you could buy several more boats. Eventually, you could have a whole fleet of boats. And then instead of selling your catch to a middleman, you could sell directly to the processor, eventually opening your own cannery. I mean, you could control the product and the processing and the distribution. You'd probably need to leave this small village and move to Mexico City, then maybe to Los Angeles, eventually to New York City, where you could expand your enterprise. The fisherman looked at him kind of stunned and said, well, how long is all this going to take? To which the investment bank replied, oh, about 15 to 20 years. And so the fisherman said, but then what? And the American laughed and said, well, that's the best part, because when the time is right, you would announce an IPO and sell stock to the public and become very rich. You could make millions and millions of dollars. And the fisherman looked at him and said, millions of dollars? Then what? And the American said, well, that's what's so great about it, because then you could retire. You could move to a small coastal fishing village where you would sleep late and fish a little and play with your children and take siesta with your wife and stroll into the village in the evenings where you could sip wine and play guitar with your amigos. You know, living in America provides so many great opportunities. But sometimes I think pursuing the American dream, as it's become, is somehow a nightmare for far too many people. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon speaks from experience. And he speaks from experience on the topic of how having it all can still leave you feeling a little bit empty in life. Now, you know, one of life's great challenges, you've heard this before, is that you don't know what you don't know. Well, Solomon had incredible experience. He speaks from experience, and so he knows a lot. And Ecclesiastes appears to be the kind of book that a person would write towards the end of their life, kind of reflecting on their life's experiences and lessons that are learned. And we've got to remember, I've told you before, there's two ways that we can learn, either through wisdom or through consequences. And that wisdom is a lot easier way to learn. And Solomon already experienced a lot of the consequences, so we can learn some things from his experiences. For example, here's some of the experience. He starts out in chapter 1 and says, I said to myself, look, I've increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much wisdom and knowledge. Now, that shouldn't be surprising if you know anything about Solomon, because God promised that he would have greater wisdom than any other person on this earth. His problem was that he didn't always live very wisely. And that can be, I think, attested to in these next few statements that he makes, because when we get to chapter 2, he says things like, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure and find out what's good. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. He had some experience. And then he went on in chapter 2. He says, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. And boy, did he build houses. He had a number of palaces, but the main one took him 13 years to build. It was so magnificent. And then he goes on, I amassed silver and gold for myself, the treasure of kings and provinces. Now, the wealthiest people living today are usually referred to as billionaires. Solomon could be referred to as a trillionaire. I mean, it's estimated that his worth in today's dollars would be somewhere around $2.2 trillion of personal wealth. Now, just to put that in perspective, you know how much $2.2 trillion is? If you were able to spend $1 million a day, it would take you just over 6,000 years to spend $2.2 trillion. Now, does he speak from experience of having it all? As someone who thought that he just had it all, could satisfy the cravings of his heart, Solomon speaks from experience, and he says, you know what? I know what it's like to have it all. And I know what it's like to still feel empty. Now, that should give some credibility when Solomon reveals four very unsatisfying pursuits in life. Now, before I share those, one of the thoughts that is repeated a number of times in the book of Ecclesiastes is that there's nothing new under the sun. Solomon says that over and over again. And a lot of people read that and say, well, if Solomon lived today, he'd never say anything like that, because today there's a lot of new under the sun. I mean, he didn't live when there were, you know, smartphones and people going to the moon. And let me just say, he's not talking at all about technology. There's lots of new technology. What he's talking about are the basic principles of life, that the principles have been the same, are the same. They never change. And people, since the beginning of time, have looked to these four things to bring them satisfaction and meaning in life. The first of which would be possessions. Possessions. And Solomon, of course, he had an abundance of possessions. And yet, notice what he says. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The second thing would be pleasures. And Solomon enjoyed a plethora of pleasures. And yet, here's what he says, I have seen, and he could say, I've experienced all the things done under the sun. And he says, ultimately, all of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Another one would be power, and a lot of people pursue power. Well, Solomon had it during his reign. He went unchallenged in his leadership of Israel. And in chapter 4, he says, there was no end to all the people who were before them. And he's talking about rulers and leaders there. But notice he says, but those who came later were not pleased with their successor. In other words, he was noticing how power didn't last for very long. It actually had it over to somebody else. And he says, this too is meaningless, kind of like a chasing after the wind. And then prestige. And Solomon experienced a lot of prestige. There were people that traveled from the four corners of the world to hear about Solomon's wisdom. It was so great. And when you think about it, prestige is often about who's more important, or who's more significant. And notice what he says about that. He says, I saw that all toil and all achievement spring from one person's envy of another. I want to have as much or more than they have. And this too, it's meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Now, did you notice how Solomon repeats the same phrase as he tries to describe the unsatisfying nature of these four pursuits? He likens all of this to a chasing after the wind. And when you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, you'll come across this particular word picture at least 9 times. And it's really, I think, kind of the perfect analogy because it's easy to get the picture of chasing after the wind. How fruitful is that ever going to be? But then isn't it true that what we're often sold or try to be sold in this world today and what we assume is going to bring us satisfaction in life is exactly these four things: possessions and pleasures and power and prestige. And what we need to hear is Solomon in his experience is saying, you know, if I had it all to do over again, I would not make the pursuit of these things the top priority of my life. I've been there, I've done that, I got the t-shirt, but I never found what I was truly looking for. He was saying, you know, if I had a do-over, I would live differently. And that's not that really an uncommon of a life experience, is it? There was a hospice nurse who compiled hundreds of hospice patient responses highlighting the top 5 regrets that people had who were dying. And here's the top 5 that she recorded. I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself and not the life that others expected of me. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. I wish I had let myself be happier. And see, Solomon is trying to wake us up to the fact that we need to start living with the end in mind, because the truth is, yesterday ended last night. It's on the books. We can't do anything about it. So imagine for a moment that you're lying in a bed. Maybe you're surrounded by friends and family, or maybe you're there alone. Perhaps you saw this coming, or maybe it came as a total surprise. Well, the nurse comes in with a look on her face that tells you what you already know. And she says, the end is near and it's time to prepare for what's ahead. And in that moment, what's going to be running through your mind? And if you were asked the question at that point, what would you do differently? What would you say? Well, Solomon is trying to say to us that if he had it to do all over again, he would do it differently, because he finally realized that what he thought was going to be so important was in fact meaningless. Now, part of the grouping that the book of Ecclesiastes is in, it's in a portion of the Old Testament that's identified as poetry. Now, it's because it's written with a real different style. If you've read Proverbs and Psalms, you know that, and you get into Ecclesiastes the same. And as you read through, you're going to notice, wow, it seems like 2 different people talking, and it's almost as you're hearing from 2 different people. And one of them is the teacher, and you'll recognize the voice because you'll hear a lesson that they're wanting to deliver. But there's also this person that's kind of like a critic that you're hearing from, who quite frankly sounds like the devil's advocate when it comes to talking about life. And when he's writing as the critic, what he's highlighting is what often causes us the greatest frustration with life. And as the critic, Solomon highlights 3 uncontrollable realities of life that we struggle with. Every one of us here has to deal with these 3 things. The first is time. Time. And have any of you ever noticed that regardless of what you do, time keeps marching on? Haven't we all said, I wish I could stop time, but it just keeps going. And as it goes, we just go through these cycles of life. I've experienced so far about 57 springtimes in my life. I know that summer's coming next, Sometimes the seasons have a little trouble figuring out where they're at, like we've experienced here. But in chapter 1, verse 9, notice he says, what has been will be again. What's been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. And see, you know, the younger that you are, I've noticed this, the bigger deal birthdays are to you. But the older you get, if you notice, you don't really care. You don't know that you really have to celebrate your birthday again because we keep adding another 365 days to our collection. But I just want to encourage you this morning. You've probably heard this before, but what we've discovered, we know for sure, is that the more birthdays you have, the longer you live. And so don't worry about having more birthdays because it'll help you live longer. But what happens is, oftentimes as we get older, we tend to envy those who are younger because we know as time marches on, we're getting closer to the end. But you know, the only reason we're older than them is because we were born earlier in the timeline. And when they've lived as long as we have, they will also be as old as we are. And so time marches on, the same for all of us because it's out of our control. We don't have any control over it. Little break in the message there, everybody catch a breath. I would just imagine that probably every one of us here has heard that song, Turn, Turn, Turn. And it became an international hit in 1965 when it was released by the Byrds. But it was actually written by a guy named Pete Seeger in the late 1950s. Well, when I say written, he didn't really write the song, you know, he wrote the music because the lyrics, except for the title, which is repeated throughout the song, and the final two lines, the lyrics were taken word for word from the first eight verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And amongst other things that it reminds us of is yet another one of these uncontrollable realities of life, which is death. And it says, there is a time for everything. There's a season for every activity under the heavens. And notice what tops the list. A time to be born and a time to die. Now, a person who works in a hospice environment had this to say. She says, I help people who are dying for a living. I work in hospice, and death has become as common a part of my routine as brushing my teeth or having that first cup of coffee to start my day. When that ever popular question comes up in conversations, what do you do for a living? The response I get is always the same. Wow, I don't know how you do it. I could never do something like that. When I tell someone that I work in the end-of-life care, it's almost as if people will put you on some godlike pedestal where you're suddenly you possess the saintly gift to deal with that one awkward and uncomfortable subject that no one ever wants to bring up, death and dying and end-of-life. She goes on, most people look at me and think that I still have a lifetime of experience in the world than all it has to offer. Sure, my life has just begun, and there's a whole life ahead of me, according to what society tells. But what I've experienced with working with terminally ill, what it's afforded me is the opportunity to see and appreciate life in a way that I never thought I could. That life is fleeting, and you only get one chance to do it right. That's part of our reality of life. The third one is what I would call randomness. And the randomness of life can be frustrating. We'd like it to be more organized, but all of a sudden things that we think should be a certain way aren't that way. And in chapter 8, verse 14, he says, there's something else meaningless that occurs on the earth. The righteous get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked get what the righteous deserve. That's random. It shouldn't be that way. And all of us have seen really bad things happen to really good people, and we've seen really good things happen to really bad people. And so I want to walk you through this excellent video, kind of helped me get the picture of it from, again, readscripture.org that kind of sets up how this all looks.
So why does the author want us to hear from the critic?
Well, he wants to turn your view of the world upside down, and he's going to let the critic explore three really disturbing things about the world.
And we should warn you, these are pretty intense.
Yeah. So the first is the march of time, or as the critic says,
generations come and generations go, but the Earth, it's been here long before us and will be long after. No one remembers people from long ago, and all the people yet to come, they too will be forgotten by those who come after them.
So, on a cosmic scale, you and I, we are just a blip. Stars are born, and then they die and form planets which orbit new stars, and those planets, they change over time and eventually burn out.
And amidst this cosmic backdrop, my entire existence is like a blink in time.
Which leads to the critic's second disturbing observation, that we are all going to die.
Humans face the same fate as the animals. Death. All people. The righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, those who offer sacrifices to God and those who do not. They all share the same destiny. All this activity and madness, then we all join the dead.
Man, this book is depressing.
And so is the final disturbing thing for the critic, and that is life's random nature.
So in Proverbs, life isn't random. There's a clear cause and effect relationship between doing the right thing and being rewarded.
But the fact is that life doesn't always work that way. The critic has observed a glitch in the system. He calls it chance, or in his words,
the race doesn't always go to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food always come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the educated. Time and chance happen to them all.
So his point is that you can't really control anything in life. It's just way too unpredictable.
So if I want to master life,
then you're setting yourself up for a fall. Now, throughout the book, the critic uses a metaphor to tie together all of these disturbing ideas. Nearly 40 times, he says that everything in life is hevel. It's a Hebrew word that means smoke or vapor. Like smoke, life is beautiful and mysterious.
It takes one shape, and before you know it, it takes a new shape.
And smoke looks solid, but try and grab it, it'll slip right through your fingers.
And when you're stuck in the thick of it, like fog, it's impossible to see clearly.
Now, our modern translations have lost the metaphor, and they usually translate hevel as meaningless. But if you read closely, the critic isn't saying that life has no meaning, but rather that its meaning is never clear. Like smoke, life is confusing, it's disorienting and uncontrollable.
So what are we supposed to do with all of this?
Well, surprisingly, the critic first of all acknowledges the perspective of Proverbs. He says it's a really good idea to learn wisdom and to live in the fear of the Lord.
Really? I mean, he just said that doesn't guarantee success.
But he knows it's the right thing to do. But secondly, and more often, he says that since you can't control your life, you should stop trying. Learn to hold things with an open hand, because you really only have control over one thing, and that's your attitude towards the present moment. Stop worrying, he says, and choose to enjoy a good conversation with a friend, or the sun on your face, or a good meal with people that you care about.
The simple things in life.
Yes, and both the good things and the bad, because both are rich gifts from God. And that's the surprising wisdom of Ecclesiastes.
So helpful, because you know what? Really, humanity lives with this conundrum. And it's just a part of the tension of life that we have. And the conundrum is this: life can appear to be meaningless. That's what the critic keeps bringing up. And if we don't really keep up with this perspective, it can be easy to operate under the hevel mindset. Hey, it's all kind of meaningless. And so a lot of times people are wondering, is life really worth living? And I think that really has become almost the question of the day, when there are so many in our society that are choosing to prematurely end their lives, I think, because they say it's all meaningless. And I would just say, anytime you take God out of the equation, which mankind seems so prone to do, it's going to be hard to view life as meaningful. And so fortunately, there's a solution. And the solution is to include God in every aspect of your life. If your life feels meaningless, then it's probably because there's an absence of God in that part of your life. That's the message of Ecclesiastes. Here's what the teacher has to say right at the end of the entire book. It says, "Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind." Now, when he's talking about the fear of God, to fear God means to acknowledge that this is his world and that he's ultimately in charge and in control. And what that means is that life always goes much better when we align ourselves with his truth. And then in chapter 2, verses 24 and 25, it goes on, the teacher, "A person can do nothing better than eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or drink or find enjoyment? Without him." See, God designed this world to make sense only if we live it in his presence and acknowledge him and his plan and his purpose. See, we really are a big deal to God, but we're also a little deal compared to God. And so we try to run things and be in control of things that we're not in charge of. And ultimately, instead of trying to add years to your life, you should be more concerned about adding some life to your years. And the way you do that is by connecting your life with God. I love what the video says. It says, "The only thing you really have control over is your attitude concerning the present moment." Another person who works in end-of-life care happened to say this. It says, I used to look at life like I was an indestructible hurricane having 80 or more years ahead of me to make up for my string of immature missteps and mistakes. That's no longer the case. To me, life is no longer something that I feel entitled to. Instead, I now see it as a precious opportunity to wake up and simply live another day as a significant blip in this vast universe. Does that sound cliche? Well, take it for what it's worth. Because sitting and holding the frail hand of a woman who's lived 90 years as she takes her final few shallow breaths, or hearing the story of how a handsome World War II vet met his sweetheart walking home from school back in 1945. And after 8 children and 1 home and 50 wedding anniversaries, he couldn't imagine loving anyone else. Or watching my father get carried away at 59 under a white sheet as tears streamed down my face. I came to learn that life is not just a series of meaningless daily occurrences. There's more to living than purely existing. It's a wonderful, terrifying, incredible, impeccably perfect journey, and you only get a one-way ticket. So what do we do? Well, as the video said, we're just more open-handed with life. We learn to enjoy and appreciate the little things of life. Now, if you notice down at the bottom, there's a PS at the bottom of your sermon notes. And I just came across something this last week that I'm really going to try to incorporate as many messages as possible to add a PS to all of the messages. And the PS means practice and share. Because if you want to make the most of your half hour or so that you have to sit listening to me every week, probably the best way to do that is to say, well, from that, what am I going to practice and what am I going to share? Because as you practice it, it'll put it into your life, and as you share it, it'll become even more ingrained. So I have something I want to share with you as a practice to help make life more meaningful. Here's the first thing. I will look for and become more aware of the little things in life that I can enjoy and be thankful for. Now, what does that mean? Honestly, basically, it means you should stop and smell the roses. I mean, literally, stop and smell the roses. You know, we're so familiar with them, we're so used to them, we walk by, and we don't happen sometimes to notice the incredible beauty that God put, the color. And then as you get closer, you smell the aroma of this flower. And you have to stop and say, wow, God created the earth with incredible color. He gave us the olfactory ability to be able to take in the smell. I need to be thankful for that. Let me ask, how many of you have had a good meal in this past week? I bet everybody had at least one. How many of you would like to have another one this week? And another one. And another one. It's something that you will never tire of. And yet when you enjoy food, do you ever thank God for actually creating you with taste buds that allow you to savor the flavor? I mean, he could have just made us with tongues and no taste buds, and we just eat the food just because we need to stay alive. But no, he created it and then created the food to be even satisfying. And let me just say that that gratitude for those simple little things is part of what will keep any of us from sinking into depression because life just seems to be so meaningless. In his book, The Seven Decisions, Andy Andrews talks about the power of gratitude for just the little things in life. And here's what he writes. He says, just as a fresh breeze cleans smoke from the air, so does a grateful spirit remove the cloud of despair. It's impossible for the seeds of depression to take root in a thankful heart. Listen to that again. You know, one of the struggles of our society is depression everywhere. And part of it's because we've forgotten to be thankful. It's impossible for the seeds of depression to take root in a thankful heart. He goes on, my God has bestowed many gifts upon me, and for these I will remember to be grateful. Too many times I've offered the prayers of a beggar, always seeking more and forgetting my thanks. I do not wish to be seen as a greedy child, unappreciative and disrespectful. I am grateful for sight and sound and breath. And if ever in my life there is an outpouring of blessing beyond that, then I will be grateful for the miracle of abundance. I'm the possessor of a grateful spirit. Want to get rid of meaningless? Learn to have a grateful heart. So that's practice. Then share. And I would just encourage you this week, just say, as I engage in conversation, I'm going to bring up those little things in life that I'm learning to enjoy and be thankful for, and I'm going to give God credit. And I want you to practice that right now. So we're going to do something we don't normally do in church. I'm going to have you talk out loud. And so what I'd like you to do is you get in groups of two or three or maybe four. If you see somebody sitting by themselves, make sure you include them in the conversation. And I want you to just think for a moment and say, what's something that I take for granted every day that I really should be thankful for? And tell the person next to you. Practice that right now. I wish we had time to listen in on some of your conversations because you know what? I think we would hear some things today that would say, wow, yes, I ought to be thankful for that too because I've been taking that for granted. If your life is feeling a little bit meaningless, Ecclesiastes is a great place to go and remind yourself, hey, what's really important? And then to be thankful for God for what he's provided. Let's pray. Father, I thank you today that we have an opportunity to pause in our busy schedule. Life is out there, and as soon as we leave, we're going to hear about how important possessions are and pleasure is and power is and prestige is, and we're going to be caught up in maybe pursuing that instead of just pursuing you and understanding that you're really where meaning and purpose in life comes. Father, you've blessed us so much. I would just pray for every one of us here today that our eyes this week would be opened in ways we've never experienced as we see things that you've given to us that are an amazing blessing and that we'd be grateful and thankful for that. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.